Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the most likely explanation for what happened to the settlers who vanished from the colony at Roanoke and why it's been downplayed or ignored for more than 400 years. We'll spend this hour with Andrew Lawler, who developed his own Roanoke obsession as a boy taken to visit the island. He later used his adult skills as a journalist to pursue both old and new leads. We'll talk about what colony leader John White found when he returned with fresh supplies after 3 years away and about other possible clues discovered through the centuries. We'll also discuss Virginia Dare, the first baby born to an English mother on American soil, and how she's become a potent symbol for white nationalists. Our conversation starts after a short break. Leonard Nimoy was the source of my first obsession. His documentary series, In Search Of, did an exceptionally creepy episode on the lost colony of Roanoke when I was 8. Colony leader John White had left the settlement soon after its establishment to fetch extra supplies to keep more than 100 men, women, and children going on this island colony off the coast of North Carolina. When White returned 3 years later, their encampment had been cleared out with just a couple of cryptic clues as to their whereabouts, including the word Croatoan carved into a post. White's own daughter had been among the settlers, as had his granddaughter, Virginia Dare, the first English child known to be born on American soil. He never laid eyes on them again. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My childhood obsession faded after a while, but author Andrew Lawler's was fed by early visits to Roanoke Island itself, and it persisted into adulthood. As he discovered, the story of Roanoke has been told and retold in different ways for hundreds of years by Americans whose ideas about race, immigration, and what it means to be an American have colored their interpretation of what must have happened. Lawler's new book is called The Secret Token: Myth, Obsession, and the Search for the Lost Colony of Roanoke. He joins us from the studios of WUNC in Durham, North Carolina, to talk about it. Andrew, welcome back to Think.
Hi, Chris. It's a pleasure to be back.
So this is really interesting. The Roanoke mystery was nearly forgotten for more than 200 years. How was it revived in the public imagination by George Bancroft?
Well, as you mentioned, for a couple of centuries after the first English settlement in the New World had failed, it was forgotten because people don't really like losers, and the Lost Colony certainly was lost, and therefore people really didn't give it much thought for at least 2.5 centuries after the events that took place in the 1580s, that is, during the time of Queen Elizabeth. And as you mentioned, it wasn't until the 1830s that historians began to revive the story, but in a very different way than people had thought about it previously.
What was going on in the 1830s that called for a retelling?
Well, remember, that was a time when the founding fathers were mostly gone. Most of them had died by then. And there was a president who was quite mercurial and was really splitting the country in two. It was Andrew Jackson. And during that time, many Native Americans, thousands and thousands, were being pushed west across the Mississippi so that Southern planters could move into the Deep South and begin to create plantations. And, of course, they were bringing with them enslaved Africans. And with that came problems. In the early 1830s, there was a rebellion by Nat Turner in Virginia, actually just about 100 miles north of Roanoke Island, that really frightened a lot of Southern whites. So it was a time of great anxiety. In the North, there were lots of Germans and Irish that were coming into the country in very large numbers. Most were Catholic. And this really made white Americans of English heritage quite anxious about the future of the country.
And here was a story that appeared to be about a bunch of innocent white English people somehow imperiled by being in this place.
Yes, the story, you know, originally was that the colonists were lost and who knows what happened, and that was that. But then in the 1830s, a historian, George Bancroft, wrote a best-selling History of the United States, one of the first real histories of the country, in which he cast the lost colony in these very romantic terms as something that was a mystery. It was kind of in the same genre as Edgar Allan Poe, who was a young writer at that point. And this really interested people, particularly women. What I found was fascinating was that women really gravitated to this story of the lost colony, primarily because one of the characters in this historical drama was Virginia Dare.
The first English child born on American soil. What do we know about her, Andrew, for a fact? And what kind of narrative did later generations drum up about her?
Well, Virginia Dare is probably the most well-known American about whom we know so little. We know when she was born, 1587. She was born of Eleanor Dare, who, as you mentioned in the opening, was the daughter of John White, who was the governor of the colony, who had returned to England for supplies and then was delayed on his return. So we know that she was born. We know she was baptized. And after that, silence. Other than that, we just know her name. She was named Virginia after the name of the country that had been bestowed on the area by the English, named after Queen Elizabeth, the Virgin Queen. So that's really all we know. So for women in the 1830s who were really desperate to have female figures in early American history, and there were virtually none, here was this child who was really, you know, in a sense, the first DNA that appeared on American soil that really related to the later English domination of the entire continent.
And there were a couple of other babies born after Virginia Dare to English women, right? But nobody wrote down what their names were or what their sexes were.
Yeah, we know that there was a baby born just probably a few days after Virginia Dare. Now, remember, they had just landed on Roanoke Island after a very long, like a 6-month sea voyage. So imagine being pregnant on one of these ships that is tossing its way across the Atlantic Ocean from England, then arriving, and finally you have your baby. But as you say, we don't know much about what happened. We don't know anything, really, from the historical documents about what happened once John White left just days after the baptism of Virginia Dare, his granddaughter.
Help us understand this. It seems like a strange choice for the governor of this colony to say, I'll jump onto this ship returning to the motherland to go get supplies. Why wouldn't he remain there and send other people?
Well, this is one of the many mysteries around the Lost Colony, which is so fascinating. There's so many ways of answering that question. I think it seems pretty clear from the documents, which mostly come from John White, which makes it very difficult to have another point of view. John White said, hey, we need supplies. I'll go back to England. I will bring back more settlers. I will strengthen the colony. He actually didn't want to go himself. He wanted to send someone else. But the colonists got together and they said, no, we need you to return to England because you have the political pull to be able to get people's attention, to get the attention of Sir Walter Raleigh, who was a courtier in the court of Queen Elizabeth I, who had really set in motion this entire venture. Now, whether the colonists were telling the truth, they really wanted him to go back because he was the influential person who could get the ear of important people at court to ensure that they would be resupplied, or whether this was a very clever way of getting rid of an ineffectual governor is something that historians are still debating.
What was Raleigh's goal for this colony? Were they supposed to just plant a flag? Were they putting down tobacco? What were they supposed to be doing there?
Well, let's step back and look at the world in the 1580s. This is 20 years before Jamestown begins to take shape in the minds of people who want to try again. So in the 1580s, the world was primarily dominated by Spain, which was the first real global empire. They were incredibly wealthy. They had looted so much of Mexico and South America. This was a country that controlled the trade routes across the Pacific as well as the Atlantic and the Indian Oceans, and the wealth was just pouring into Spain. England, by contrast, was extremely poor, peripheral, isolated. They didn't have much in the way of technology. They didn't really have many navigational skills. Their science was backward. So England was really was not a player at that time when it came to the colonization of the New World and other parts of the world that were opening up because of the rise of European military and ship technology. So the English realized that they had to do something. And Sir Walter Raleigh kind of took the bit between his teeth and said, okay, we're going to raise the money and we're going to get the expertise we need, which was in part foreign expertise, in order to make a colony in the New World. Now, the goal was multifold. They wanted to create a pirate base because ships were sailing up the Gulf Stream, Spanish galleons full of all kinds of good things, and the English wanted to steal the plunder. They also wanted to look for a shortcut to Asia. There was actually some talk that the Outer Banks of North Carolina, which are a very thin strip of islands, actually led directly to the Pacific Ocean. And there was a lot of excitement around that because you wanted to get to China. That's where the real wealth of the world was centralized in those days. And then also they were looking for pharmaceuticals and, of course, gold. But pharmaceuticals was a big part of it. They were interested in things like sassafras, which was a plant that was said to cure syphilis, which at that time was rampant in Europe. So there were a lot of reasons for the English to get together and try and create a colony to begin to tap into the wealth of the Americas.
And then, to John White's great good fortune, he returns to England and finds it completely preoccupied with rumblings of war between Spain and England.
Yes. Yeah, so it was actually the second colony. There was a reconnaissance mission in 1584 that went to the Outer Banks. And then there was an attempt to send 100 or so men to set up a kind of military base and scientific base on Roanoke Island on the Outer Banks. And they ran into trouble with the Native Americans and were forced to leave quickly before even a year was up. So when the lost colonists arrived in 1587, it wasn't really good timing because, number one, the Native Americans were not friendly at that point to the English, with the exception of one small tribe called the Croatoan, who remained English allies. And the other problem was that Spain and England were inching toward war. And this was serious business because Spain was a superpower, and England was not. England was a small country with a very small navy. So when it became clear that the threat of Spain was heading toward England in the form of a large armada, the Spanish Armada, Queen Elizabeth said, "No ship shall leave England." And John White, who was one of the most unfortunate people in history, he managed to arrive back in England from Roanoke Island just weeks after the Queen had declared that no ship would leave England until the threat from Spain had passed.
Just to be clear, that trouble that the military colony settlers experienced with Native peoples, it had a lot to do with the fact that Native folks started realizing they were getting very quickly sick and dying as the English started to arrive, right? They were being poisoned, basically, by European diseases.
Yes. You have to remember that Native Americans did not have the same immunity from very common diseases like the flu, which for Europeans might be an inconvenience but rarely cause death. So when the Europeans arrived, very quickly, Thomas Harriot, he was a scientist who was part of that first colony I mentioned, he noted in his journal, it's very strange that we go to visit a village, and then a few days later, the people in the village start dying. Now, they didn't have the germ theory yet. They didn't know about viruses. So Harriet was kind of puzzled by this, and the Indians were as well. They thought that the English were firing invisible bullets, which is actually a very good description of what was happening. And the leader of the Native Americans in the area asked the English if they could point their invisible bullets at their enemies in order to kill off the Native American tribes that were in opposition to this one tribe. So it was a very confused situation. Nobody really understood what was happening, but it did seem to show that the English were powerful in a way that the Native American peoples could not really grasp.
My guest is author Andrew Lawler. We're talking about his new book, The Secret Token: Myth, Obsession, and the Search for the Lost Colony of Roanoke. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or go to Twitter. We are at @KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Andrew Lawler about his new book, The Secret Token: Myth, Obsession, and the Search for the Lost Colony of Roanoke. Join us at 800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERAThink. So, Andrew, it was 3 years before John White returned to the place where the colony had set up?
That's correct. So he arrived back in England at the end of 1587. The Spanish Armada comes to England. There's a gigantic battle. The English do win that battle, but the threat from Spain remains, and John White simply cannot find a way to get back to the New World. He tries three times. First time, the ship at the last minute is recalled to England by the Queen. The second time, pirates attack him off the coast of Morocco, and he's wounded in a fierce battle on deck and gets back to England barely alive. And then the third time is the charm. He finally makes it back. But by then, it's August of 1590. In fact, when he arrived back on Roanoke Island, it was the third birthday of his granddaughter, Virginia Dare.
So initially, there were reassuring signs. He saw evidence of fires burning where he expected to find the colony off in the distance. Describe to us the scene that he came upon.
Well, when the ship anchored off of the Outer Banks, John White was delighted because the first thing they saw was a plume of smoke that came from Roanoke Island itself, where the colonists had been left behind. So he was very optimistic, thinking that, well, they're there, that's a signal, they're waiting for us. And so the next morning they got in the ship's boats and they sailed toward Roanoke, and then they saw another column of smoke a little bit closer, just to the south, and they decided in the spur of the moment, well, let's check that out because it's close by. And they, by the time they got to that plume of smoke, there was no one there. And it's not clear if it was a man-made fire or whether it was set by lightning. We don't know. So then by the time they get back to the ship, it's late. The next day they set out. The weather's gotten bad. One of the ship's boats overturns, and seven men were drowned. And the sailors wanted to go back on the ship and sail away from this terrible place, which is famous as the graveyard of the Atlantic. Very rough waters, shallow, extremely treacherous. But John White, obviously pleading, probably on his knees, convinces them to go on to Roanoke. And by the time they get there, it's late at night, and they're delighted to see a fire burning at the north end of the island, which is where he had left the colonists. The next morning, after they had been singing English songs all night in the hope of getting an answer from some of the colonists, they go ashore, and they find the remains of a fire. Again, we don't know if it was set by people on purpose or not. And there's no sign of anybody, but they do see footprints in the sand, which makes it clear that Native Americans are tracking them and following them, but won't show their faces. And by the time he gets to the abandoned settlement, all he can find is carved on a post beside the entrance to the settlement is the word Croatoan. And this was exciting to him.
Yeah, because...
The Croatoans were the allies of the English, and Croatoan was an island to the south. We'd now call it Hatteras. And he said, I greatly joyed to know that they were with friends.
So the thought is you would go straight there and find the settlers. What did he find?
Well, again, John White's ill luck intervened, and there was a terrible storm that night. And the next morning, as they were setting sail for Croatoan, which was only 50 miles south, not far at all. In fact, they had passed right by it on their way there. The cable holding the anchor broke, and they almost shipwrecked. And the captain said, look, we only have one anchor left. We can't risk any more losing the final anchor. We've got to sail away and come back in the spring. And so John White had to agree to this. And so they sailed away, probably within just a few miles of Croatoan. And John White returned to England and was never able to get the attention of Sir Walter Raleigh or other English courtiers to put the money together for another expedition. So he died. We don't know where, we don't know when, but we do know that he must have led a very... He must have felt some terrible blame and guilt for what had happened to the colonists and the loss of his own daughter and granddaughter.
Were those colonists the only foreigners in the area?
Well, no, the Spanish had been in eastern North America for decades and decades. St. Augustine had been founded long before. There had been French settlements along the coast of what is now Florida and South Carolina and Georgia. And so it was actually pretty well known to many Europeans. The English, however, were late to the game. And when they settled in probably the worst spot you could choose, a place that's very difficult to get a ship in and out, a place that didn't have a lot of land to grow crops because it was very swampy. So it was really a poor choice to create a sustainable colony. But it was a great choice if you wanted to dart out from the Outer Banks and capture a Spanish ship.
Okay, so this clue, Croatoan, was sort of tracked with what the colonists had agreed with John White that they would do if they had to move for some reason. And they also said, look, if there's trouble, we will put another symbol next to the word indicating our whereabouts. That symbol didn't exist. So why is there so much consternation about what really happened to these people?
Yes, John White had agreed with the colonists before leaving in 1587 that if they went anywhere, just write down where you're going, and if you have to leave in distress, then leave a Greek cross. Now, when he returned, he found just the name Croatoan, but not a Greek cross. So it was a sign that they departed without fearing for their lives. So at that point, you would think, well, okay, they moved down to Croatoan, or at least some of them did, and the English could simply go to Croatoan at some point and find them. But for the next 20 years, there was at least 15 years, the war with Spain dragged on, and it made it very, very difficult for investors to get the kind of money together that was needed to send ships and men across the ocean to a place that had proven not very hospitable to people. So time went by, and gradually people simply forgot about these people. There was war, there was this trouble at home, Queen Elizabeth died. There was a lot of concern about the stability of England at that point. So the fate of 115 men, women, and children on the other side of the ocean didn't really concern many people, including Sir Walter Raleigh.
How did Virginia Dare become a symbol of white nationalism?
Well, having grown up not far from Roanoke Island and having learned all the stories as a child, this was one of the biggest surprises of my research. As we talked about earlier, it wasn't until the 1830s that Virginia Dare was resurrected as a figure, and as a figure much beloved particularly by women as the first child of English descent born in the New World. But the way in which she was described in the 19th century was often as the first white child born in the New World. I thought, okay, well, that's kind of odd because the Spanish were there long before, as we discussed. There were Portuguese, there were French, you know, lots of Europeans were in the New World prior to the English. The English were late to the game. So what did that mean? And of course, what it meant was that to be white in, say, the 1830s meant to be of English heritage. And those Germans and Irish often were not considered white. So What I realized was that by tracking the story of Virginia Dare, I could actually track kind of the national level of anxiety about issues of race and immigration. So I realized that the Lost Colony is a fascinating mystery, and I was pursuing the archaeology and the other science going on to try and answer that question. But this deeper question struck me as even more interesting, and that is, how is it that the Lost Colonists became a symbol of white supremacy in the 19th century, and Virginia Dare as a symbol of the dangers of a blonde white girl left in the wilderness surrounded by dark savages? It was a myth that became wildly popular well into the 20th century.
And people who embraced that kind of mythology found it inconceivable that this girl of English heritage would have, say, met and married a native husband.
Yes, all of the stories portray Virginia Dare as this beautiful, blonde, blue-eyed creature wearing a kind of sexy doeskin outfit. And she's good with a bow and arrow, but she remains virginal. She's always pursued by Very handsome Indian braves in these 19th century stories, but always manages to say, you know, no, I'm going to remain pure. And in the end, in one of the most popular stories, she's actually turned into a white doe by an evil Indian shaman. And then an English hunting party accidentally shoots this white doe, who then transforms back into the girl, Virginia Dare, and then she tells her story before dying and blesses the English hunter, saying, well, now I know that you've come back to the New World, and you're going to conquer the New World and bring civilization to this barbaric place. And this was a poem and a legend and a myth that was really popular in the South and in the North well into the early 20th century.
And even today, there's a website called VDare.
Yeah, this was, again, one of the surprises was I thought, okay, well, this is a 19th century story, you know, a time when the United States went through the Civil War, you know, the big bloody debates about whether or not we would continue to enslave people. And my surprise was that actually Virginia Dare remains a symbol for many people of the need to prevent immigrants from coming into this country who could further mix our gene pool and pull us away from this Anglo-American heritage. So as you mentioned, there's this website I found, vdare.com, that uses Virginia Dare as a symbol of the need to restrict immigration. And this is, I found this fascinating, that Virginia Dare, this child born more than 400 years ago, continues to be this projection screen, which, of course, tells us much, much more about ourselves than it does about a dead Elizabethan.
And, of course, she was the child of immigrants.
She was indeed. They were the first. And, you know, what's interesting is that historians today agree pretty much that the colonists almost certainly assimilated with the Native Americans. Now, perhaps by force, maybe they were captured, maybe they were enslaved, but that they eventually assimilated into Native American society. That if you're hungry, then you're going to go to the people who know how to feed themselves. And what struck me, and this is true from my study of the archaeology of the area, is that the English were very inept when it came to feeding themselves. They weren't well supplied. They expected the Indians to provide them with food. And the Native Americans at first were very happy to trade with them because they liked the idea of getting metals and guns and knives and hoes. But eventually they said, you know, enough, we only have so much food. So what's really, when I dug into the current knowledge based on the science and archaeology, it's clear to me that the Native Americans were central to helping Europeans establish a foothold in the Americas. And in the case of the Lost Colony, they almost certainly took them in.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Andrew Lawler. His new book is called The Secret Token: Myth, Obsession, and the Search for the Lost Colony of Roanoke. Okay, so there are centuries of legends, a lot of which are colored by people's needs to tell a certain kind of story. Now there is archaeology. So tell us about some of the physical clues that have been found and the ones that may or may not really be attributable to the settlers in this colony.
Yeah, there have been some very exciting breakthroughs in the past few years, and that's what started me on this story in the first place. In 2012, a very clever University of North Carolina professor noticed a patch on a map that John White himself, who was the governor of the Lost Colony, but also an artist on the first expedition, he had drawn a map of eastern North Carolina. And the professor asked the British Museum, which owns this map, if they could take a look at it and see what's under the patch. So when they slid it on a light table there in London, the curators noticed that underneath this patch they could see a drawing of a fort 50 miles west of Roanoke Island, that is 50 miles inland. And what's interesting about this is that the planters had planned to move 50 miles into the main, that is 50 miles west into the interior. And here was an image of a fort covered over, perhaps to keep the Spanish from knowing they were there, because the Spanish were eager to wipe out the English. The Spanish claimed that territory as their own. And what was even more intriguing about this clue was that on top of this patch, drawn in urine, which was used as an invisible ink, was another image of a fort. So it wasn't just a mistake. They drew a fort. There's no fort there. Let's cover it over. You know, they went to the trouble to paint with invisible ink on top of this map, on top of the patch. So this was incredible news. It was the first real break in the case in more than 400 years. So archaeologists rushed to the area in which the fort was thought to exist, and they began to dig. The First Colony Foundation began to do extensive digs over several years, and sure enough, very close to a Native American village from that era, they found European artifacts. Now, it seemed at first really convincing when I went to visit, but then as I began to talk to archaeologists and look at the evidence, it became clear that it's very difficult to pinpoint a pot that dates to, say, the 1580s versus an English pot that dates to the 1640s, when the English were again back in North Carolina and settling. So I think the evidence from what's called Site X remains controversial. The archaeologists who work there strongly believe they have clear evidence that at least some of the colonists moved inland. They moved in basically with the Native Americans. But I think they have more work to do before we can say conclusively that this is evidence from the colonists themselves.
My guest is author Andrew Lawler. We're talking about his new book, The Secret Token: Myth, Obsession, and the Search for the Lost Colony of Roanoke. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you've got a question, call 1-800-933-5372. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Andrew Lawler. His new book is The Secret Token: Myth, Obsession, and the Search for the Lost Colony of Roanoke. Okay, Andrew, tell us about the ring and the rapier found on Croatoan.
So your listeners might be wondering, well, if John White, when he returned in 1590, found a tree where Croatoan was carved on it, and we know that Croatoan is today's Hatteras Island, then what has been found on Hatteras Island? And the astounding fact is that until recently, no one had bothered to look. And it was only because of a hurricane, actually. There was a terrible hurricane in the 1990s that left a good number of people on Hatteras homeless. And in the course of that, a lot of Indian artifacts were unearthed by the surging waters. And an archaeologist went and began to dig, thinking that, okay, we have an interesting Native American site. And toward the end of the dig, they found a ring. And it was a beautiful ring, clearly European, with a crest on it, with a lion on it. And nothing like it had ever been found on the Outer Banks. Clearly, it was very, very old. And the archaeologists believed it was, in fact, Elizabethan, which would be a very strong clue that the lost colonists were there, or that somebody from the Roanoke voyages had been there. He took it to a local jeweler, and when he came back, he wrote a report in which he declared it was a gold ring, which was a sign that it was owned by somebody very, very wealthy and probably quite powerful in Elizabethan England. And there it stood for another 20 or 30 years, about 10 years. And then another archaeology team arrived from England, from the University of Bristol, and led by archaeologist Mark Horton, and they began to dig. And what they found was really astounding. They came up with a rapier, which is a kind of dress sword from that era, as well as lots of lead shot and other European artifacts, including beads made in Italy. This was clearly a sign that there were Europeans there, and it was all mixed in with Native American material. So Professor Horton theorized that this was evidence that the lost colonists had moved to Croatoan, had integrated with the Croatoan, with these Algonquin-speaking people, and had kept their kind of European heirlooms, the things they had from that they had brought from England as mementos. Because part of the problem was that this material was found in what's called a later context. That is, it was found in a level that dated to maybe 50 years later. So Horton said, well, that's the problem. Clearly, these were heirlooms that people held on to. But the other possibility is that these were trade goods that had come from later European settlers along the coast. So we really don't know for sure, but it's a very, very intriguing find, as are the finds at Site X, that show us that whether or not the lost colonists integrated with the Indians, certainly early Europeans were bringing their goods and technology, with which the Native Americans were very quickly adopting.
Okay, to my favorite clue, and I gather an emotional roller coaster for you, the Dare Stone. What is it?
Okay, well, this requires a little background. So in the late 1930s, a man showed up at Emory University in Atlanta with a stone. And on this stone was an incredible story. It was allegedly written by Eleanor Dare herself, the daughter of Governor John White. And this stone told this heartrending story of how after John White left, there was a terrible massacre, and Eleanor Dare watched as her husband Ananias and her child Virginia Dare were killed. A few colonists escaped, and you can sense her terrible trauma from this event, and it's a very heartfelt cry. This got a lot of attention and scientific analysis, and the scientists of the day, the historians of the day who looked at this stone, declared it to be real. Not only did they declare this one to be authentic, but they declared several other dozen stones, which subsequently magically appeared, that kind of continue the story. It was like a serial. And the stones were found in a line from North Carolina all the way to, surprise, surprise, Atlanta.
Huh.
Now, an investigative journalist in 1940 determined that all of the other stones were clearly fake, that had been faked by a Georgia stone cutter, and everybody involved in the whole this whole crazy story lost a lot of credibility. But this first stone was never definitively tied to the other fake stones. And we know the others were fake. This one, however, was different. It was found by somebody else. It was found 50 miles west of Roanoke Island, very close to the Site X, the place we mentioned, which at the time was not known. And recently, when I showed high-resolution images taken by our National Geographic photographer to experts around the world who really specialize in epigraphy and how people wrote back then in Elizabethan times, and who study the way in which carvings are made in rock in that period, 4 out of 5 of them actually said this could quite possibly be authentic. And I was shocked, because I assumed that it was obviously a fake. But we need more scientific analysis, and the stone, which is now at Brenau University outside of Atlanta, hoping that soon will be subjected to some really modern technological tests, because if it were true, if it were authentic, then the answer to what happened to the lost colonists has been staring us in the face for more than 50 years.
So expert number 5, who said, I don't think this is real, and threw cold water on it, what were the arguments against its veracity?
Well, this was a professor from Oxford University whose response was something along the lines of, this resembles the way Dick Van Dyke spoke English in Mary Poppins. In other words, really bad, really bad fake. But when I took his specific arguments to other epigraphers and other people who are expert in Elizabethan writing and Elizabethan word usage, they were much more giving. They actually said that there's nothing on that stone that definitively could be said to not fit Elizabethan style. But again, this is something that needs investigation. And the way we probably will get at it is by several lines of evidence. For example, to use the patina, that is to look in the little crevices of the carving to see if there's the right kind of fungus and mold that would have taken hundreds of years to grow. In other words, it was carved long ago. So if we can use those kind of high-tech methods combined with experts' kind of testimony in the world of epigraphy and stone carving, then I think there could be a definitive answer coming soon.
Do the descendants of Native people who would have been living in the area back in the 16th century, early 17th century, do they tell any stories that might correspond to this mystery?
Yes, and this was one of the more, what can I say? It was very surprising to me and kind of sad because there are people living in eastern North Carolina who are considered African American and have been since the 1830s or 40s. Because at that time, you were either white or you were black. There were no mulattoes or half-breeds or even Native Americans. You were white or you were black. And as a result, a lot of the history and the, you know, the interesting kind of mini cultures that grew up in that part of the state were lost and ignored and never written down. But still, there persist lots of traditions among Native Americans and among African Americans who now are reclaiming their Native American heritage. People who say, you know, we're not just black. We're black, we're Native American, and we're white as well. And there's good evidence, genealogical and DNA evidence, that shows that people in eastern North Carolina, and particularly in isolated areas, are, you know, they're a melting pot. In fact, you could say that the melting pot that is the United States really began when Native American refugees settled in the swamps and then enslaved blacks escaping from plantations mixed with them, and in turn whites showed up. So you have this very rich mix of cultures which came together. But as I said, much of their history was never written down and has been ignored. And I'm hoping that some of these stories can come back and really enliven and enrich our understanding of early America.
My guest is author Andrew Lawler. His book is The Secret Token, Myth, Obsession, and the Search for the Lost Colony of Roanoke. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You know, Andrew, when you say DNA, in the 21st century, we're sort of conditioned to assume that there will be the case will open and the case will shut and that DNA will give us all the answers we need. So can't we just ask everybody for a cheek swab who is descended from people who lived in that area at that time and definitively identify someone who was a colonist at Roanoke, a white colonist at Roanoke?
Well, this is what I thought, too. I thought, great, we'll bring some science to bear and we'll solve this problem. Well, it turns out it's not that simple. And DNA, which it can tell us so much about our past and our present, really doesn't do any good whatsoever, at least yet, when it comes to the mystery of the lost colony. That's for two reasons. Number one, you need descendants from the lost colony so you can get their DNA to know, you know, what it looks like. But the trouble is, we don't know any descendants from the lost colony for sure. The names on the list of the lost colonists are very common. John White, for example. So how do you track these people? How do you determine that somebody, that a John White today, is actually descended from the John White of then? We don't know. And the other piece is, even if you had that data, you have to have something to compare it to. And as of this moment, at least, we have yet to identify a skeleton from a lost colonist, either at Cape Creek on Hatteras or at Site X, 50 miles inland from Roanoke Island. And without those, you know, that hard physical evidence that we can then compare with current day descendants, it's virtually impossible at this point to use DNA. We have to look for other methods. And that's why I fell back on talking to people who live in eastern North Carolina about their oral history and about their traditions, because that is something that is still alive and out there. You just have to try and piece it together.
this story, you know, points out the fact that many of us were taught in history classes that life in America sort of started when Europeans arrived, which, of course, is complete nonsense. And in some ways, you know, our interest in this story lends itself to the same kind of narrative, right? Because the individuals who were living at Croatoan are sort of seen as background players because we wonder what happened to Virginia Dare and her parents and her community. But I get the sense here that you're also retelling this story as a cautionary tale for how we interpret history and the idea that maybe we need to look at what's been considered established fact with a critical eye.
Yes, and you know, frankly, in this country today, you know, history is a battleground. People are fighting over what different parts of our history meant. And that's a healthy thing because history is how we make meaning of who we are today. But in the case of Roanoke, the reason why I think it has such intense emotional power is not just because 115 people disappeared. It's because this is our creation story. This is our nation's founding myth. And how we talk about it in turn determines kind of who we are, what our values are, what kind of people we want to be. So that's why I was really drawn to this, not simply because we can solve a really interesting mystery. So I think that we can draw on the new science to get a fresh picture of what it was like then, not just what we imagine it to be. And what we know now is that Native Americans and Europeans were intimately involved with one another from the beginning, that without Native Americans, there would have been no English settlement of the New World. Without the cooperation of these two peoples, it wouldn't have worked. So in the end, I felt kind of optimistic about it, that obviously we got off on the wrong foot, but at least when it comes to the lost colony, it seems that here we have two very, very different and distinct cultures coming into contact for the first time, and it's quite possible and actually quite probable that the two merged and created something new. And that's what interests me, is that we created something new, and I think that's what Americans do so well. So I don't think we have to look at this as a history of victims versus conquerors. There is that, and it's definitely true. But there's this other piece that we actually can look to our better angels of this country who can take from other cultures and other languages and other traditions and make something that is fresh and new and exciting.
Andrew Lawler's new book is The Secret Token, Myth, Obsession, and the Search for the Lost Colony of Roanoke. Andrew, thank you so much for making this time to speak with us.
It's been a pleasure, Chris. Always is.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think. Subscribe to the podcast using your favorite podcast app or go straight to the website, think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.